From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet actor Gary Oldman. After playing characters on the edge like punk rocker Sid Vicious, playwright Joe Wharton, assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, Dracula, and a Soviet terrorist, he's making his screenwriting and directing debut with the new film Mill by Mouth. This is a realistic drama set in a working-class neighborhood similar to the one Oldman grew up in, where alcoholism, drug addiction, and spousal abuse are common. Also, sexual addiction, does it exist? We talk with Dr. Abraham Verghese about the controversy within the medical community. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A federal judge has declared unconstitutional the president's new line item veto authority. U.S. District Court Judge Thomas Hogan said in his ruling that the line item veto disrupts the balance of powers among the three branches of government. The authority allows the president to reject individual items in a spending bill without vetoing the entire measure. Hogan was ruling in a case involving New York City. A final decision on the constitutionality of the line item veto is likely to be decided by the Supreme Court. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says the Clinton administration and U.S. European allies are looking into the possibility of indicting Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein for crimes against humanity. She told a congressional panel that investigators have been collecting evidence for a possible war crimes indictment against Saddam. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says the Senate will not approve an Iraqi resolution this week. Lawmakers continue to be critical of the administration's plan, saying the objectives are unclear. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Senate leaders are having trouble with the details of the administration's plan for an air attack against Iraq should diplomatic efforts fail. Lott says House and Senate leaders will send a letter of support to the White House, but there will be no Senate resolution this week. Republicans like Judd Gregg of New Hampshire say the results of an airstrike could be positive, such as the destruction of Saddam Hussein's weapons, or negative if Saddam manages to use those weapons.
But those are unintended consequences because there appears to be no intended consequences. Literally, there are no intended consequences. If the intended consequence isn't to replace him, and the intended consequence isn't to destroy the weapons, what is the intended consequence of a military action?
Military experts say either of those stated goals would require the use of ground troops, something no senator has endorsed. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Art museum directors will testify before a House panel today about efforts planned to trace art looted during World War II. David Darcy reports.
The hunt for art looted from Jewish families during the Holocaust is an emotional issue for many Jewish Americans and a possible threat to American museums whose collections are being scrutinized. Today's hearings are triggered by the Manhattan District Attorney's subpoena of two paintings from Vienna that were in a Museum of Modern Art retrospective that are being claimed by survivors of Holocaust victims. The directors of the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, and the National Gallery of Art in Washington are expected to tell the committee that U.S. art museums will now pay special attention to art looted by the Nazis that found its way into the U.S. market. But legislators will be getting only one part of the story today. Although dozens of Holocaust victims or their descendants have claimed works of art in American museums, the House Banking Committee has not invited any to testify today. For NPR News, I'm David Darcy in Washington.
Wall Street, the Dow is down 61. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after 2 days of record-setting advances, the stock market is trending lower today. Not only is the big board down, but the NASDAQ Composite Index is down nearly 14 points. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has more.
Investors are troubled by overnight weakness in several key East Asian stock markets, particularly Indonesia, which was down about 10%. At the same time, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin said the impact of the Asian financial crisis could be very substantial if the region's economic difficulties worsen. Mr. Rubin and Fed Chief Alan Greenspan will speak to Congress later today on increasing funding for the International Monetary Fund. In the Treasury market, long-term interest rates moved lower after the government reported a smaller-than-expected increase in retail sales during January. I'm Doug Krisner.
President Clinton has proposed a $1 increase in the minimum wage to $6.15 an hour spread over the next 2 years. He announced the plan in remarks to Democratic members of Congress this morning. Some Democratic lawmakers have proposed larger increases stretched over a longer period of time, but White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry said Mr. Clinton settled on the details of his proposal after a review of the issue by the National Economic Council. In 1996, the Republican-controlled Congress approved the first increase in the minimum wage in 5 years. At that time, it went from $4.25 an hour to $5.15 an hour in two steps. Eastman Kodak Corporation is attempting to strengthen its internet-based photography business. The company says it will buy a 51% interest in closely held Picture Vision, its biggest online competitor. Financial terms were not disclosed. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information at 800-644-7733.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Putumayo World Music, presenting Romantica, great love songs from around the world. Available at cafes, record, gift, and bookstores worldwide. 1-888-788-8629.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gary Oldman has made his reputation playing extreme personalities like punk rocker Sid Vicious and playwright Joe Orton, who was murdered by his lover. Oldman played Oswald in JFK and Dracula in Coppola's adaptation. Last summer, Oldman starred as a Russian terrorist in the thriller Air Force One. Gary Oldman doesn't appear in his new movie. He makes his screenwriting and directing debut. The film is called Nil by Mouth, and it's set in a working-class neighborhood similar to the South London neighborhood where Oldman grew up. Spousal abuse, alcoholism, and drug addiction are commonplace. In this scene, a mother walks into her pregnant daughter's home to find her daughter swollen and bruised around her face and body. The daughter has been beaten by her husband, but she lies and says she's been hit by a car.
Look, that's where he hit me there, see? See, with the side of the headlights, right? And then I went smack into the road on my face, and then when I looked up, he'd gone. I mean, it was lucky I didn't have Michelle with me, you know, because he'd have probably have hit her as well.
He killed her. I mean, didn't no one see it? No one mooching about?
No, it was down, you know, down the back, down by the old shops, down there.
Well, weren't you looking?
Yeah, of course I was looking, Mummy. He just seemed to come out of nowhere. And then when I looked up, the had gone.
What's the hospital say? Is the baby all right?
Yeah, you know, they gave it a x-ray scan thing and, you know, they had a little look and that. It's just bruising and that, but I don't know how I felt, Mum. I mean, look at my fingers there, look.
Oh,
they hurt the most. They hurt more than this.
Are they broke?
I don't know.
Well, didn't they say?
No, they sort of concentrated more on the baby, didn't they?
The movie is shot in an almost documentary fashion. Scenes are drab and gray. I ask Gary Oldman why.
The film deals with codependency and chemical dependency and absent fathers. And I wanted to really take the gloves off and honestly look at those areas. I think Hollywood just recently, or it's unfair to say Hollywood, but the movies just recently, they've tended to sort of slightly romanticize it and glamorize it. And I can think of, you know, I can think of movies like Pulp Fiction and recently Trainspotting. And obviously it's a very personal film to me. And these are issues and areas that have either directly or indirectly touched me. I know people who are addicted to substances, be it, you know, alcohol or heroin, and I felt that if you're going to portray it and show it, then you should really show it for what it is. It's a killer disease, and it destroys people's lives.
I think that Nil by Mouth connects to your own past. You grew up in a working-class family.
South London. Yeah.
And the movie's dedicated to your father, who I believe passed away while you were making Sid and Nancy, mm-hmm. and who I believe left your family when you were a boy. How well did you know him? And let me ask you this first. What is it about the film that connects to your father that inspired you to dedicate the film to him?
Well, it's certainly, if he hadn't have left mm-hmm. when he did and died when he did the way he did from alcoholism, I would be, I guess, a different person. You know, that has obviously influenced me and shaped me psychologically. So I don't know whether I would have even made this film or made a film but not about the subject. And as I say, one of the areas that the film deals with is there's no authoritative figure there. There's no father figure in the film. There were issues that were unresolved, I think, with my father. Stuff that baggage that you carry around with you. And I felt that it was time to not forget, but in some way forgive. It seemed to me a very obvious and a very fitting dedication. And also, I think I've achieved some, you know, some great success in my career. And my father has not been around, wasn't around to see any of this.
One of the main characters in your new movie is an alcoholic who's also abusive to his wife, and she needs to figure out whether to stay with him or mm-hmm. leave, and that's going to be a hard choice for her. Was your father abusive when he drank?
No. My father is the father that Raymond in the movie talks about. But my...
And that's a father who was just emotionally unresponsive.
Yeah. And I don't remember my father saying he loved me. You know, I'm sure he did, but there's a lot of stuff that I think I've blocked out. A lot of stuff I don't want to remember. But I can't remember him saying that to me. So that fueled that area, that other dynamic of the history of Raymond, mm-hmm. in a sense. But my father was not an abusive man, and he certainly didn't beat my mother. But those kind of characters, as we say, you know, the unsavory kind of character who has been on the outskirts of the family, and we've had our ups and downs with them. You know, domestic violence and abuse, you know. We've had our share of it.
We theoretically know a lot more now about how to deal with addiction and codependency than we did when you were young, you know. But that doesn't make it any easier for anybody, I think. How did your mother deal with it when your father drank?
I think she just ignored it. That's still there for us, for these people in the movie. For those people back there that are still living like this. Well, I mean, I've moved on from that neighborhood and that life, if you will, and I became an actor. And you can transcend class and mingle with, you know, rock stars and kings and queens, you know, in this business. And and my life has a bigger, a broader outlook on life. And one has developed a palate, and there's a certain sophistication that has come with that. And if I have a problem, I certainly don't have a problem with entertaining the idea of maybe going to see a therapist or get help. But these people won't in this film. These people need help, and unfortunately, they won't get it because they don't have the access. So really, it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed in 25 years.
Right.
For that neighborhood, for that culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why don't you describe the neighborhood that you're from? Which I imagine is like the neighborhood depicted in the movie.
Yeah, it's very much like the neighborhood in the movie. I would say it's matriarchal in as much that the men are out and they're out working, and when they're not working, if they're not working, in fact, they spend a great deal of their time, you know, up the pub, and the women are at home, as my mother was. And as my sisters have done, you know, assuming some responsibility, looking after the kids. And it always struck me that the men were out up the pub, you know, talking nonsense, and the women were back at home talking common sense. And they were what was holding it together. But I think it's hard because, you know, Valerie, who is Raymond's wife, played by Kathy Burke in the movie, she, you know, a lot of women are trapped, almost captive, held hostage in that kind of situation, in that kind of marriage. And they live in these high rises, and, you know, the spaces in these places, I mean, they're no bigger than the studio I'm sitting in here, in this little booth. And when you're a captive in a house with that rage and that anger, a lot of people still live like that there, you know?
I know there was a period in your life when you had a problem with alcohol. Did you feel that connected to your past and to your father's own problem? And did you feel like you were going to have the same kind of problems that he had? I mean, did you feel any of that connection?
Oh, yeah. You start to... I was working from a blueprint, you know, almost, even though I don't remember him being around to influence me. As someone that I looked up to and watched and listened and as some kind of role model, it didn't even matter that he had not been there. I was still working to some kind of almost predestined sort of pattern, and following, making a lot of the I think have made a lot of the same mistakes.
You know,
I'm walking in his shoes.
When someone's an alcoholic in the neighborhood that you grew up in, you know, he is going to hang out at the local pub probably and come home and maybe be really crude and maybe even violent around the family, but he's going to live in a really circumscribed world. When you're a movie star and you have any kind of addiction problem, you have the money and the celebrity to kind of cater to any appetite that you have. Mm. And I think it's a kind of like different world for someone who has an addiction problem, who's famous and has access to money.
Yeah. Well, also, you're working, you know, you make money, and in turn, you make money for other people. You become like the sort of a tiny, microscopic kind of Gary Oldman industry, you know, within the industry. So that there's people earning money, and of course, they want to say yes.
They want to indulge you, right?
Yeah, you're brilliant. You're this. Yeah, man, you haven't got a drink problem. Yeah, you're just wild. You're out there. You're an artist. You're on the edge, you know, and that old thing of like, you know, I need the drink because, you know, I've got to, it gives me an edge, it gives me a spark, and all of that. That is, you know, bull, really. That's not the artist talking. That's a drunk talking. That's
right,
the booze
right.
Talking.
Well, don't you think artists can be pretty good at using that, though? You know, like,
oh,
I need it for my art to get in touch. And
oh, yeah. I think that you can use it creatively, and I've certainly, in my battle and struggle with it and out of my recovery, I've tried to use it in this movie in a very constructive way. But I think that sometimes these you know, you can really get indulgent, can't you, with pain and mm-hmm. all that misery. Mm-hmm. you can and again, that's the drunk in you or the addict in you that wants to keep you the addict. You know, there's always an excuse. Because you can say, hey, man, I feel depressed and whatever, I'm going to have a drink. Hey, the sun's shining. Let's have a drink. Hey, it's your birthday. Let's have a drink. It's Christmas. Hey, it's a funeral. Let's have a drink. So there's always an excuse for it, you know? And at the end of the day, you know, I mean, I just had to turn around and say, I ran out of excuses.
My guest is Gary Oldman. His new movie is called Nil by Mouth. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Oldman is my guest, and he makes his screenwriting and directing debut with his new movie, Nil by Mouth. Everyone in the movie has a very kind of thick working class accent. And
yeah.
a lot of the talk in the movie is just kind of riffing with a lot of expletives, you know, telling colorful stories and so on. I'm wondering if you had that kind of accent when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you see, well, you're talking to Gary Oldman, who went to drama school, you see. And I had to lose all of that, you see, because you can't talk like that if you're going to do Shakespeare. And my training was for the theatre. But when I was growing up in South Atlanta, yeah, I used to talk like that, you see, you know, when I was a young kid, yeah.
Now, do you think that affected your early career and your ability to get into drama school in the first place?
No, it didn't, because if you think of some of those great actors in the past, I mean, you know, if you think of someone like Albert Finney, he's from Manchester, he used to talk like that, Albert. You know, if you look at those early films like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, and you look at Tom Courtney and The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and all of those that early, late 50s, early 60s work, Michael Caine, mm-hmm. who played in the Ipcress file, who played that character, Harry Palmer. He wore that Cockney accent, you know, around his neck like a chain, you know. But no, because they're looking for that raw talent. They're looking for something that is obviously not honed and shaped, and then they do their work on you, you know. And they try and iron out some of the rougher edges.
Now, I know when you were young, your father was a welder, and I'm wondering if you remember what the meaning of work was in your family and in the families around you when you were growing up, if the people who had jobs liked their jobs, and what it would have meant to you to find work that you loved.
Yeah, I think I'm very lucky. I'm very, very lucky that I'm in a profession where, for the most part, I wake up in the morning and I want to go in and do a job.
Yeah, what did work mean when you were young?
Just earning enough money so that at the weekend you can spend it and not think about working next week, really.
Did you have a fallback plan if you didn't become an actor?
No, I didn't. I did work. I worked in... I was a Saturday boy in this store called British Home Stores, and I sold sports equipment, and I worked in a shoe shop and stuff like that. I mean, I did some other stuff before I went to college, but I didn't really have a backup. I had no plans, actually. There wasn't even, you know, some... There wasn't even a plan for this crazy thing I wanted to do called acting. You know, it just seemed like a good idea one day. I'd never read plays or seen plays or any of that. You know?
What about movies? Did you see a lot of movies?
Yeah, I saw a lot of movies. Yeah, the very first movie I saw at the cinema was A Hard Day's Night.
Oh, the Beatles.
And I guess I must have been about six.
Wait, and how did your accent compare to their Liverpool accents? Because, you know, Americans were dying to have the Beatles' Liverpool accents when they got really big in the 60s.
Yeah. Oh, the old Liverpool like that, eh?
Yeah.
The old sound of John Lennon used to talk like that. Well, it's just for... I mean, you can... It's amazing that you can... There's a different accent in North London, and then you can just travel a couple of miles, and then it changes again. It's very much like here in the States.
Oh, sure, even from New York to Boston, it's different.
We're just all on top of one another because we're just in this tiny little island. So it's just that you have to travel further to hear the change. But in England, it's odd because, you know, 10 miles up the road, the accent has, again, completely changed. But the Liverpool accent is sexy. And then when it comes out of the mouth of Paul McCartney and John Lennon, it's even sexier.
Right. There's a character in your new movie, Nailed by Mouth, who in one scene, there's Apocalypse Now is on television or on video.
Yeah.
And so this character just recites word for word along with Dennis Hopper as Hopper does one of his monologues in the movie. Was this you as a kid? I mean, not necessarily with Apocalypse Now, but I mean, with other films, did you like memorize long sequences by heart and recite them along with the movies?
Yeah, Yeah, I used to do that. I just never seen that. You know, we're so obviously so our culture's so influenced by movies and by television. And I'd never seen that in the film where someone had could mimic the character and talk along with it as they were doing it. And I know many people that can do it. I know a lot of actors that can do it. And I have chunks of dialogue from films that I can recite.
Which ones?
Well, I can think there's some stuff from Raging Bull, a bit from sort of Taxi Driver, Scarface, was it Lenny? You remember the
right? Yeah, Lenny with Dustin Hoffman as Lenny Bruce.
You know, I can who I try to do on a good day. You know, you never know. So I have and some stuff of you know, because we all like walking, so. There's some Deer Hunter I do.
Oh, I hear a little Christopher Walken coming in through there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do a bit of that. And so I, you know, we have fun with that. And my friend, the painter, Julian Schnabel, I mean, he's watched The Godfather 500 times.
Uh-huh.
To the point where the dialogue from the movie peppers his conversation. And you kind of go, hang on a minute, where do I know that from?
Right.
You know? And
oh,
you go,
exactly.
God, that's The Godfather. You know.
What's your favorite Taxi Driver monologue?
The mirror, I guess.
You talking to me?
I also like the De Niro at the beginning of Raging Bull. The two scenes that kind of bookend the movie, with him in the mirror in the nightclub, you know. But us actors, we when we get together. I was recently working in London on a movie that comes out in April called Lost in Space. And I was working with Matt LeBlanc from the series, the TV series, Friends. And we would do Al Pacino all day, you know. We would just do scenes from Scarface and Serpico. We're just having fun. So I thought it'd be great to... I thought, I'd like to see that in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the scene in, of course, and then people sort of say to me, you know, the way you use the music and it crosses over and there's Raymond, who is this lonely figure in the kitchen and he's partially naked and he's got his hand up on his head. And someone said to me, yeah, man, he said, that's the Apocalypse Now and that's Brando, isn't it? And, you know, I love the way that the themes and the images that you've used. And, of course, to sound like a very sort of intellectual, very intelligent director, I said, yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Gary Oldman, he makes his screenwriting and directing debut with the new film Nil by Mouth. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Additional support comes from Rising Tide Entertainment, presenting the soundtrack for The Apostle, featuring Lyle Lovett, Stephen Curtis Chapman, The Sounds of Blackness, and others. Available in record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Gary Oldman about the films that established his reputation, Sid and Nancy, and Prick Up Your Ears. Also, is there such a thing as sexual addiction? We talk with Dr. Abraham Verghese about the controversy within the medical community. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Gary Oldman. He makes his screenwriting and directing debut with his new film, Nil by Mouth. Last summer, he starred in Air Force One, which has just come out on video. He played a Russian terrorist who hijacks the president's plane. Here's Oldman's terrorist on the phone with the vice president, played by Glenn Close.
What are your intentions?
What arrogance to think you could ever understand my intentions.
I want to understand what it is that you want.
What do I want? When Mother Russia becomes one great nation again. When the capitalists are dragged from the Kremlin and shot in the street. When our enemies run and hide in fear at the mention of our name, and America begs our forgiveness. On that great day of deliverance, you will know what I want.
Gary Oldman first established himself on screen as punk rocker Sid Vicious in the 1986 film Sid and Nancy. Here's a scene from the film.
Among the under snow, and so I face the final curtain. Can't. I'm not a queer. I state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, and each and every highway, and not much more than this. I've lived my
Your breakthrough movie role was in Sid and Nancy, where you played Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols. How did you get that part?
Well, it's a strange history to that, because I was working in the theatre. I was doing a play, and Alex Cox and his producers, Eric Fellner, came through, were looking for the guy to play Sid, and they saw me in the play. And we met, and then they offered me the part, and I turned it down.
Oh, that was smart.
Yeah.
Why'd you turn it down?
Because I was not really interested in Sid Vicious and the punk movement. I'd never followed it. It wasn't something that interested me. It was, you know, the script I felt was banal, and who cares, and why bother, and all of that. So, and I was a little bit sort of with my nose in the air and sort of thinking, well, the theatre, you know, so much more sort of superior and all of that, you know, I was a young kid. Anyway, so I ended up turning it down, and turned it down again, and then my agent called me and he said, you know, look, you're crazy, you've never made a movie before. But I was earning at the time a little under £100 a week at the Royal Court Theatre, standing on the stage, doing all that very worthy stuff, you know. And my agent said to me, well, they do want to pay you $35,000 to do this movie. And I thought, and so it's strange. I was talking about this the other night, that great art is not always necessarily where you think you're going to find it.
Right. It's a terrific performance. I really like that film a lot.
And so my initial motivation for doing it was money.
Uh-huh.
And yet it was in many ways a landmark performance and a landmark film, and it got me going. And then there's those other situations where something comes with an incredibly good pedigree. All the pieces are falling into place. You know, it's going to be just wonderful and artistic, and you know, and you go into it and it doesn't happen and it doesn't work.
You were terrific in Prick Up Your Ears, which was a biographical movie about the British playwright Joe Orton. Did you know his work having started on the stage?
Yeah, I've been in a couple of Joe's plays, and most notably, I suppose, is a very famous play of his, Entertaining Mr. Sloan.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew him from the theatre, and he was one of the playwrights that we studied in college.
Joe Orton was gay, and a lot of the movie revolves around that aspect of his life.
Promiscuous.
Mm. There's even scenes in, like, you know, public bathrooms with him, you know, cruising. And there's, I think, for its time, the mid-80s, there was the kind of kiss that you wouldn't usually see in films. I mean, there was very little about homosexuality in films then. And I think a lot of actors would have been afraid to take that role, afraid that, you know, the public wasn't ready for it, that they'd think the actor was gay and that would hurt the actor's career, etc. Was that ever a consideration for you?
No, it may have done. It could have done. I never thought about it like that. I never looked at it like that. I just thought, well, what a great character, what a great part. And I was working with the guy, Fred Molina, the actor who played Joe's lover in the film, Kenneth Halliwell. Dear friend of mine, lovely man, Fred. That was his first screen kiss for Fred. Yeah, kissing me. And he said to me afterwards, he said it was very nice, but he said, just shave next time. He said it was like rubbing my face up against sandpaper. Now we know what girls have to go through.
The women put up with. have you seen Alfred Molina in Boogie Nights?
I haven't seen Boogie Nights
yet. He's really good in it.
Yeah.
So do you think that after playing these really, you know, like big eccentric characters like Sid Vicious and Joe Orton, that you started to get roles of extreme personalities? I mean, yeah. I can't think of any roles where you played someone who would be considered average, you know, the typical Englishman or the typical American.
Yeah, no, I know. I became, for a while there, I became the sort of bio kid. It was, you know, he lived, he's famous, get Gary Oldman.
but it was also, you know, he's got a huge ego, or he's really crazy, get Gary Oldman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's really over the top. He's an incredibly eccentric character. Get Gary Oldman.
Well, maybe those parts didn't start off like that. It's just
maybe
I turn them into, maybe it's my influence on those roles that make them that probably they feel bigger than life and a little over the top. I mean, I do go for it a bit as an actor. I must admit.
This past summer, you starred as the terrorist in Air Force One.
Yes,
and I'm wondering what you think the pros and cons are of working in, you know, major motion picture action thrillers with big budgets, and because I would imagine that there's both, that there's some great things and some drawbacks.
Well, I think that, you know, I am sometimes in movies that I don't particularly like, or that I wouldn't go and see, and I think that Wolfgang Petersen is a fine filmmaker. And I had a lot of fun on that film. I had a lot of fun working with Wolfgang, and it's technically very, very well put together. But at the end of the day, you know, it's not quite my cup of tea. But I invested a lot of my own money in Nil by Mouth. I wanted creative freedom, artistic freedom, and that comes with a price tag.
Right.
So, in a sense, a movie like Air Force One will subsidize the other work.
How will you feel if you lose money on Nil by Mouth? Say,
oh, I have done.
Excuse me?
I have done.
You've lost money?
I will. And I won't see the money. I'll see some of it, but not much.
But it's worth it to you if you do lose money?
Oh, yeah. When I set out to make this film, my partner and one of the producers of the movie, Douglas Urbanski, we had discussions about this, and I said, you know what, if this doesn't get any distribution and no one sees it, I don't mind because, you know, I made it for me and a couple of friends. And I said I will pull it down from the shelf and dust it off and maybe show it to a couple of mates every couple of years. So I didn't worry about any of that. And I was quite prepared to go in and do this and make a loss, you know.
Toward the end of Nil by Mouth, there's a scene in a bar where people from the neighborhood are singing, and one of the women who sings is the grandmother in the movie.
Mm. Yeah.
And the actual vocal credit at the end of the film, you know, in the credits, is to someone whose last name is Oldman. Is the singer someone who's related to you?
Yes, Kathleen. It's my mother.
Oh, and so
My mother sang that song. That's I remember my mother singing the song, also over the credit sequence.
Did I mention the song is Can't Help Loving That Man?
Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine. And over the credit sequence, I use the Andrews Sisters singing By Me and Mr. Shun. You know, that's there because my mother sings that song and harmonizes with my two sisters.
Oh.
And my mother sang that song in that pub in the movie. That these are most of the locations are the actual locations. So my mum has stood on that stage in that pub and sang that song.
In real life as well as in the movie?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you feel about her singing in pubs? Did you go listen to her when you were young?
Yeah, she was never. She has a terrific voice, but she's. I mean, you can. I mean, that's not a bad rendering of that song, and she's 76, so that's not a bad set of lungs on her.
No, that's what's sweet about it. I mean, she's obviously an amateur, but there's something really nice about the way she sings it.
Yeah, but she would get up and very much like they do in the scene. Really, it was. Uh-huh. You know, go on, Mum, go on, get up and sing a song. Give us a song, and. So there's all through the movie, it's a very, very, very personal film because all through the movie there's I have little things on the wall and I have something sitting on the mantelpiece in a shot. And it's, and if you knew, you know, you would spot it or recognize it. So it's littered with a lot of that stuff, you know.
Well, Gary Oldman, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
And good luck with the movie.
Thank you very much.
Gary Oldman makes his screenwriting and directing debut with the new film Nil by Mouth. Here's his mother singing.
Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly. I've gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine.
Coming up, one doctor considers the question, is there such a thing as sexual addiction? This is Fresh Air. You've probably been hearing the term sex addict, used to describe a person who can't seem to get enough sex and who takes great risks for sexual adventure. But is there really such a thing as sexual addiction? In an article on the current edition of The New Yorker, Dr. Abraham Verghese examines the controversy within the medical community. Dr. Verghese's interest was sparked by his former medical student and tennis partner, who was addicted to cocaine but claimed his larger problem was sexual addiction. Verghese is now writing a book about him and addiction within the medical community. Dr. Verghese is an infectious disease expert and a professor of medicine at the Texas Technical Health Science Center. He's also the author of a 1995 book called My Own Country, about treating people with AIDS in a small southern town. I asked him what sexual addiction is supposed to mean.
Well, the term is one that's very controversial. People who use the term sexual addiction feel that the behavior falls into the same rubric of other addictions, that it has the same features. In other words, this is a person who is preoccupied with sex much the way a heroin addict or a cocaine addict might be preoccupied with a drug. They engage in a great deal of risk-taking in order to satisfy that craving. And then at the end of satisfying that craving, they experience remorse, guilt, and then the craving starts all over again. So in that sense, people who use the word sexual addiction feel that it falls into the model of other addictions because there are great parallels in the behavior in these conditions.
What is the controversy within the medical profession about this concept of sexual addiction?
I guess the controversy really rides on the fact that sexual behavior, sexual activity is so much a part of being human. So clearly we're talking about a spectrum of behavior that some people choose to view as abnormal or that the patient, a person himself, uses abnormal. I think the biggest difficulty with this is the fact that historically, sexual behavior, whether it's considered proper or improper, has been very much a function of the times. For example, in the earliest editions of the psychiatric manual called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-1, homosexuality was a disease, and so was nymphomania. And it's interesting that that reflected the sexual mores of that time. And then in the 70s, in the heyday of the sort of sexual freedom and sexual exploration, those diseases, quote-unquote, dropped out of the diagnostic manual, almost reflecting the fact that in that era, it would have been very difficult to call behavior that was previously called nymphomania a disease. And I think in a strange way, we've come back to a sort of Victorian ethic in the 80s and 90s, and once again, one finds sexual behavior being categorized as a disease. And we've seen this before. We've seen this with homosexuality. We've seen this with other behaviors that don't fit in with society, getting labeled with a disease label.
I think some people are skeptical of the idea of sexual addiction because they see it as a way of almost absolving yourself of responsibility for your sexual behavior, saying, well, you know, I'm doing this because, well, I'm ill. It's out of my control, therefore I'm not responsible if perhaps I've even taken advantage of people along the way.
That's right, and I think that's the biggest critique of sexual addiction is that the behavior is somehow out of one's control, that one cannot bring any sort of rational or cognitive affect to bear on that behavior. And I think that's the part that generates the most intense arguments between the psychologists on the one hand, who see it as a form of compulsion, if anything, and the addictionologists on the other hand, who see it in the same vein that they see heroin addiction and alcohol addiction as something that's literally a disease with a discrete mechanism and that is best treated by the 12-step sort of approach rather than by psychotherapy and trying to achieve insight and so on.
Maybe you could clarify a little bit the difference between a compulsion and an addiction.
Well, to use an example that's commonly used by psychologists, if I have a craving for chocolate and you happen to have some chocolate in the room where I'm sitting, I may succumb to that urge to eat the chocolate and I may feel out of control. That feeling out of control is not to be confused with actually being out of control. So the psychologists who believe in the compulsion would argue that people who label themselves sexual addicts are not really out of control. They just feel out of control. Whereas the addictionologists would argue that they really are out of control, that this is a disease that makes it impossible for them to resist the urge that they then satisfy.
Now, how is the concept of sexual addiction affecting your work as a doctor? You deal with infectious diseases. A lot of the people who you see have HIV. You write in the New Yorker piece that you believe that one out of every 10 patients that you see is there with a problem related to alcohol or drug addiction. Do you think about the possibility of sexual addiction in the patients that you treat?
You know, I don't. I'm tremendously impressed with the phenomenon of addiction. I think it's terribly important in medicine, and it's so ubiquitous that in a way we've almost lost sight of it. But yes, as I say in the piece in the New Yorker, it seems to me that directly or indirectly, a great majority of the patients I see have problems related to their addictions, and these tend to be very concrete addictions to alcohol, to heroin, to cocaine. But I've never, in the course of 15 years of practicing medicine, felt compelled to come up with the term sexual addiction. I still find it somewhat problematic. And I think that's because, unlike these other discrete addictions where there's a withdrawal, where there's clear tolerance to the drug, with sexual behavior, it seems to me that we're sort of taking one frame of reference applied to chemicals and then simply sticking it on a behavior and hoping it'll fit. But the great fear is that it's going to play into the hands of people, say, on the right, who already are sort of very vocal about pornography and its effects on society. So the label of disease to a sexual pattern of behavior plays into some of the very issues that have to do with personal freedom that we're all concerned about.
My guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Talking to Dr. Abraham Verghese about his article in the current New Yorker about whether there's such a thing as sexual addiction. You report on the concept of sexual addiction for the current edition of the New Yorker. How divided is the medical profession now, do you think, about this concept? And what ripples is this making in the medical world now?
I think the mainstream medical profession, someone like myself, a general internist and an infectious disease person, is barely aware of this term. It's certainly caught on to a much greater degree in the lay press than it has infiltrated the textbooks. And I think that in the textbooks, the people are still a bit cautious about labeling it an addiction. And the latest DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, again, stays away from labeling it an addiction. But curiously, the public seems to have quickly bought into this, and the term is being bandied around very, very commonly as though it's a clear-cut entity like cholera or typhoid.
When we talk about addiction, I guess we usually talk about a chemical addiction. You know, you're chemically addicted to alcohol, you're chemically addicted to cocaine. Is there a possible chemical component of a sexual addiction that's being discussed now?
Well, see, that's the wonderful million-dollar question. I think the reason we have so much controversy when we talk about sexual addiction is that unlike, say, cholera or typhoid, where we know exactly what the switch is at the very center of these illnesses, the whole realm of psychiatry is clouded in this sort of mystery. And with every passing year, we're learning more about the brain, and we're learning that there are discrete areas of the brain that, when affected, can result in very discrete behaviors. But I think we're many, many years away from actually getting to the very switch at the center of, say, compulsive sexual behavior, or even other diseases like, say, anxiety disorder or obsessive compulsive disorders. And I think till you get to the switch at the center of things, you will have this argument between the sort of psychologists on the one hand and the addictionologists on the other hand and the neurobiologists on the other hand. I think it just reflects the fact that there's so much to know. What is very intriguing is the fact that there is a discrete area of the brain that produces its own opium-like chemicals that allow us to feel good, say, after a long run or after consummating a sexual act, and make us feel bad, for example, when we hurt someone or we steal. And ultimately, perhaps, but many, many decades from now, it might be possible to bring more accuracy to the sort of behavior, to typify it in the way we speak of good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. But till such time, I think we're left with this very confusing term and with the polar groups that argue over it.
Do you think it's conceivable that at some point neurobiologists will find that there is a chemical component that we don't know about yet to sexual desire, and that some people have more of it and others less of it, and that that explains what we might now refer to as a sexual addiction or sexual compulsion?
I think it's very possible that we'll get very close to finding the switch at the center of things. For the longest time, the territory of the software of the brain, all our thoughts and memories, has been the territory of the psychologists. But as we learn more and more about the brain, it becomes apparent that at some level, psychology is biology. That for every thought, for every memory, there will perhaps be a discrete chemical substrate that we can identify. But I think we're a long, long way away from that. And even when we get there, how are we going to take into account the whole range of behaviors that pass for normal in one society and yet are considered deviant in another society? I think that that kind of accuracy will never come and will always be left with a certain subjectivity to this very common and confusing disorder.
Dr. Abraham Verghese's article about sexual addiction is published in the current New Yorker. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Chris Fraley. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Black and Blue, the new novel by former New York Times columnist Anne Quinlan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as we approach President's Day, we present the first of two shows on American presidents. We'll listen to the LBJ tapes with presidential historian Michael Beschloss, and we'll discuss the Nixon tapes with Stanley Cutler. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.